Mike, thank you very much indeed. It's a privilege and an honour to have been asked to contribute again to a SETS conference, and I'm delighted to be able to do that, particularly on this really crucial subject of discipleship. Over the past few weeks, I'd blocked out various sections of weeks where I'd hoped to really spend quality time thinking about this. Almost all of them have been overwhelmed in one way or another. So I do come here with some apprehension and could have wished that I'd have had more time to be able to reflect on this, particularly in relation, I think, to what I'm going to say now, because my thinking on this has taken me in a direction that I hadn't anticipated when I began. And I'm not sure. I mean, I very much am glad that this is interactive, and I think you may well want to comment on what I'm going to say in this session on discipleship in a globalized world. Perhaps I ought to say that I'm probably running the risk of falling foul of Professor Webster's warning about not listening to the world or listening to the world in a particular way. I ought to say that I absolutely affirm what he has said, that the world cannot understand itself. What I think the world can sometimes do, particularly through particularly significant people, is perhaps in a negative sense understand that there's something radically wrong. And it may pose to us questions concerning the empirical practice of the church, and in that way challenge us to recover the sources of which we've been so helpfully reminded this afternoon. So I am going to be listening to someone who certainly has challenged me, and I hope that this will be helpful as we reflect on discipleship in a globalized world. At the heart of the biblical text, which provided the motivation and shaped the practice of modern Protestant missions, is the summons of the risen Christ to go and make disciples of all nations. The influence of this great commission has been enormous, and the history of the Western missionary movement reveals that obedience to what was seen as Christ's command became the driving force which sent an army of evangelists to every corner of the globe. Despite the existence of other motives for missionary witness within the Gospels, the idea of obedience to a command, of the duty of mission, tended to overwhelm alternative texts, with the obvious danger that service for Christ, even when involving great personal sacrifice, could become compromised by a spirit of legalism. In relation to our subject of discipleship, we may ask whether or to what extent the missionary task identified in this favoured text has been properly understood. In many of the debates that have taken place in the last 30 years in evangelical circles concerning the relationship between evangelism and social action, appeal has often been made to this passage in defense of the priority of evangelism, as though the passage self-evidently justifies such a position. But reading this text within the context of Matthew's Gospel as a whole, we must surely ask what is actually implied by the activity of making disciples, and whether this is the same thing as multiplying converts by means of a verbal presentation of the Gospel, often shorn of any mention of the call to discipleship. Or again, and perhaps even more disturbingly, we must surely ask whether it is possible to make disciples, whether, that is, we can engage in faithful mission without first reflecting on whether we ourselves meet the criteria by which we might credibly claim to be disciples. Questions like these seem to me to be both necessary and urgent in view of the fact that in this same gospel, Jesus is heard repeatedly warning that many people who confess him as Lord and claim to be his disciples have no valid grounds for such confidence. His warnings make it abundantly plain that neither a correct form of words, nor the apparent ability to preach with prophetic power, nor even the exercise of charismatic gifts alone are sufficient criteria to claim the name disciple. That title belongs to those who do the will of my Father who is in heaven. Discipleship, then, is defined in a fundamental way in relation to praxis. It involves a distinctive way of being human in which the unique life of Jesus of Nazareth continues to be visible before a watching world as individuals and communities confessing him as Lord seek to walk as Jesus did. If the teaching of Christ compels us to reflect with humility and trembling at the familiar words of the Great Commission, so too, I suggest, does the witness of Christian history. And here, as earlier this afternoon, I come almost inevitably to Bonhoeffer. In 1937, in the deepening shadows of pre-war Germany, Dietrich Bonhoeffer completed a series of studies on the subject of discipleship, which, as we know, were published under the title The Cost of Discipleship. In a socio-political context in which German Christians were making terrible compromises with an evil and idolatrous ideology, Bonhoeffer subjected his own Lutheran tradition to a searching critique, arguing that Martin Luther's liberating stress on the grace of God had hardened into a lifeless dogma which divorced his doctrine from, quote, its inevitable corollary, the obligation of discipleship. In language that has become familiar, Bonhoeffer claimed that German Christianity had turned the costly, demanding grace of God into cheap grace without discipleship. Thus emptied of its ethical and moral demands, Christianity had achieved success. It had achieved success in the sense that it had become socially acceptable. But, Bonhoeffer says, it did so at the immense cost of secularizing the Christian religion as never before. Christianity, he said, had become indistinguishable from bourgeois respectability, reduced to weekly religious acts which provided spiritual reassurance to the comfortable, for whom cheap grace offered a way of avoiding the need even to attempt to follow Christ. In a sentence, we may well ponder, Bonhoeffer concluded, it is terrifying to realize what use can be made of genuine evangelical doctrine. Tragically, his testimony went largely unheard. But as Europe was engulfed in the mechanized violence of modern warfare and in the atrocities of the Holocaust, his critical analysis was vindicated as German Christianity proved itself powerless in the face of a pagan ideology. Ernst Christian Helmreich, at the conclusion of a massive study of the responses of the German churches to the rise of Hitler, concluded that they were slow to react and cannot be said to have won any glorious battles against Nazi activities and Weltanschauung. On April the 8th, 1945, Bonhoeffer's prophetic voice was silenced by a Nazi execution squad, and he sealed his testimony to costly grace with his own blood. We will return to Bonhoeffer's work later, but first I want to introduce what seems to me to be a profoundly searching analysis of Western culture, which will serve to underline the urgency and the seriousness with which the subject of discipleship needs to be examined today. we will discover that Bonhoeffer's clarion call has lost none of its relevance and power, and the failure of German Christianity in the 1940s, instead of being a kind of aberration of merely academic interest to us, is in fact a startling wake-up call to the Christian movement in the age of globalization. While Dietrich Bonhoeffer was immersed in the struggles of the Confessing Church in Germany in the 1940s, a teenage Polish boy named Zygmunt Bauman was studying the works of Karl Marx as a member of the Red Army in Soviet Russia. Driven by a Jewish passion for social justice, the young Bauman became a communist, but quickly concluded that the Marxist vision of a humane society was being betrayed in the Soviet Union. He became a sociologist, teaching at the University of Warsaw until 1968, when an anti-Semitic purge forced him and his wife Janina into exile in Israel. This was a shattering experience, made more difficult by the inability of the Baumans to settle in the Jewish state. Israel, Bauman says, was a nationalistic country, and we had just run away from nationalism. An invitation to become head of the Department of Sociology at the University of Leeds in 1972 provided a way out of the impasse and led to his long exile in Britain, which he has described as my second home. Now 80 years old, Zygmunt Bauman continues to lecture and write, producing on average one major book every year, all of them characterized by an extraordinary degree of critical insight and an undiminished moral passion. In 1991, Bauman published a book with the title Modernity and the Holocaust, a volume that created a tremendous stir, being warmly welcomed in Germany, but provoking fierce controversy in Britain, America, and Israel, where the author was accused of letting the Germans off the hook. Bauman wrote this work as the result of the publication of his wife's memoirs entitled Winter in the Morning, in which she recalled her own experience of the horrors of the 1940s, and in his words, opened my eyes to what we normally refuse to look upon. In the introduction to Modernity and the Holocaust, he confesses that he had previously accepted the widespread assumption that the ghastly events of the 1940s were correctly understood as an interruption of the normal flow of history, a cancerous growth on the body of civilized society, and a momentary madness among sanity. The Holocaust was, in other words, an aberration. It constituted a terrible, almost inexplicable interruption of the ascent of man, a reversal to the unbridled passions and barbarism from which modernity has mercifully delivered us. However, Bauman's reflections on the subject led him to the surprising and alarming conclusion that since the Holocaust, and I quote, was born and executed in our modern rational society at the high stage of our civilization and at the peak of human cultural achievement, it could not be explained away as simply a Jewish problem. It is, he says, a problem belonging squarely within modern society, civilization, and culture. Bauman's thesis in the book, then, is that the Holocaust must be seen as a rare yet significant and reliable test of the hidden possibilities of modern society, and that as such, The warnings it contains need to be heeded wherever modernization is occurring, and should provoke serious critical examination of some fundamental but largely unquestioned assumptions concerning the culture of the modern world. I want to suggest in this paper that this remarkable analysis of the culture of modernity in the light of the Holocaust can illuminate the problems that Christians appear to have in living as the disciples of Christ in the context of Western culture. At the same time, it highlights the urgent need to recover the revolutionary praxis by which discipleship is expressed. And it also suggests that Bonhoeffer was exactly right to stress the cost of following Jesus. Bauman refers several times in the book to what he calls an etiological myth, which he says underpins modern Western culture and has become deeply embedded within the consciousness of modern people. According to this myth, he says, humankind has emerged from pre-social barbarity, and despite occasional lamentable lapses into primitive modes of behavior, progress toward the time when the whole world will become civilized is continuing. Viewed through the lens of this myth, the Holocaust can be understood in only one way. It was a ghastly eruption of primitive passions, a setback on the path of progress, and therefore a summons to redouble our efforts to extend the control of civilized values across the world. But what, Bauman implies, if such a reaction ignores and suppresses evidence that there are fundamental errors in the modern worldview? And what if our failure to submit our theory of modernity to serious critical scrutiny and a determination to simply press on with the modern project may actually increase the possibility that human tragedies on the scale of Auschwitz and the Gulags will be repeated in the future? Bauman's critical analysis of modernity in the light of the Holocaust focuses, first of all, on the emergence of the kind of technical rationality which has made possible the speedy and efficient accomplishment of defined goals within modern organizations. One of the central themes of modern sociology. Nation states and business corporations alike require forms of bureaucratic organization in which precision, clarity, absolute discretion, and submission to authority become central features. In the classical period of sociology, Max Weber had identified the emergence of bureaucrats operating according to such a technical rationality and without regard to persons as a crucial factor in modernity. Weber himself recognized the dark side of this development, and in a famous and often quoted passage, wondered whether the human spirit would eventually rise up in revolt against the restrictions and humiliations it suffered in such a technical culture. The emergence of an army of specialists without spirit, combined with the power which the possession of material goods had come to exercise over the lives of modern people, resulted in human beings finding themselves trapped in what Weber called an iron cage. Let me quote the famous passage. He says, "The rosy blush of the Enlightenment seems to be irretrievably fading." This is in the 1930s. The idea of duty in one's calling, prowls around in our lives like the ghost of dead religious beliefs. No one knows who will live in this cage in the future, or whether at the end of this tremendous development, entirely new prophets will arise, or whether there will be a great rebirth of old ideas and ideals, or if neither, mechanized petrification embellished with a sort of convulsive self-importance. We might be inclined to feel that in the current fevered atmosphere before an election, that's a pretty good description of what's going on. According to Zygmunt Bauman, once we understand this central feature of the modern world, the Holocaust stands revealed as an almost quintessentially modern event. The systematic extermination of vast numbers of people was possible only in a context in which a veritable army of bureaucrats functioned efficiently and without regard to the ultimate outcomes of their individual actions. Thousands of Germans who, outside business hours, were respectable members of society, carried out their work under the influence of moral sleeping pills. The phrase is Bauman's. Acting as functionaries in a vast bureaucratic system. As Bauman says, most participants simply composed memoranda, drew up blueprints, talked on the telephone, destroying a whole people by sitting at their desks. Indeed, after the war, many of those accused of crimes against humanity argued in their defense precisely that their actions had been done in the line of duty and so possessed no moral value. And they had a point, says Bauman, when we realize that such arguments differ little from what sociology has been saying all along, or from the seldom questioned and still less frequently assailed common sense of our modern rational society. He's extremely critical of his own discipline. It's quite extraordinary, some of the statements that he makes concerning the way in which within sociology moral issues are put to one side. Bauman's critical reflection concerning the way in which his own academic discipline had marginalized issues of ethical and moral concern then broadens out into a discussion of science in general, which he describes as being a language game with a rule forbidding the use of teleological vocabulary. From its beginnings, modern science raised the flag of value freedom on its standard as it marched into the future, abandoning the binding force of all normative thinking, particularly that of religion and ethics. Once having attained a position of cultural dominance, science effectively silenced the preachers of morality, and in the process became morally blind and speechless. But having thus dismantled the barriers that might have closed off the route to genocide, science became compliant with unscrupulous power and proved itself impotent in preventing the state from engaging in systematic crimes against humanity. The Holocaust thus exposes the dangerous vacuum that exists at the heart of modern cultures, in which the power to inflict unimaginable levels of destruction on the world is developed while normative, philosophical, and ethical questions are placed off limits at the very point at which they most need to be the subject of serious and urgent discussion. The Holocaust is thus revealed, in the words of the German historian Hans Mommsen, as the Mene Tekel of the modern state. In 1990, Bauman's book on the Holocaust was awarded the European Amalfi Prize, and he delivered a lecture at the prize-giving ceremony entitled "The Social Manipulation of Morality." He confessed himself happy that the central message of the book had been recognized as being vitally important, a message he summed up as being about the hidden and unseemly face of our confident, affluent, brave world and the dangerous game this world plays with the human moral impulse. Modern societies, Bauman said, divorce morality from utility. Perhaps that should be the other way around. And while this separation lies at the foundation of many spectacular scientific successes, it must also be linked to civilization's most terrifying crimes. So for Bauman, the reconciliation and the reuniting of science and ethics is the one chance our world may have to come to terms with its own awesome powers. How might such a reconciliation take place? Well, in the first place, Bauman insists that we need to revise our understanding of the nature of the moral impulse within human beings. In the modern world, ethics, like religion, have been treated as purely human inventions, designed to function as the glue that holds society together. Morals, according to classic sociology, are socially constructed and fulfill a strictly utilitarian purpose. But the inadequacy of such an understanding of morality is clearly exposed by the horrors that scarred the history of the 20th century. What is more, it becomes impossible to speak about right and wrong when passing judgment on people who had complied with whatever was decreed as moral within the society of which they were part. In other words, the sociological understanding of morality, the argument that it's a social construction, simply breaks down in the light of the Holocaust. In a devastating sentence, Bauman comments that sitting in judgment on the perpetrators of Auschwitz was not an easy task for those who guarded the secrets of the Gulag and those who were secretly preparing for Hiroshima. What is required then is a fundamental rethink of the nature and source of morality and a search for a new theory open to the possibility that normative ethics belong to the very modality of human existence. In a remarkable passage toward the end of the Amalfi lecture, Bauman reflects on the consequences of the loss of belief in God for modern societies. The era which witnessed the unleashing of unprecedented technological powers was also the period in which the world was declared to be disenchanted by Max Weber and released from moral restraints linked to belief in the Creator by Nietzsche's announcement of the death of God. The removal of God, says Bauman, created a vacancy. The office of supreme legislator cum manager, of the designer and administrator of the world order, was now horrifyingly empty. And this vacancy on the throne became a standing and tempting invitation to visionaries and adventurers. Now man, unaided by normative ethics and unrestrained by any sense of accountability to the Creator, set about the task of restraining chaos and recreating the world. So the classless society, the race-pure society, the great society were now the task of man. but precisely the combination of enormous technological power and a determination to use this in the service of a series of humanly conceived visions of utopia made the gulags, Auschwitz, and Hiroshima possible. There are, Bauman concludes, many tasks human rulers may perform, but constructing a perfect world order is not one of them. I've just come back from Romania, where I've been teaching in Bucharest for a week, and on the Saturday morning before I went back to the airport, I was taken to visit Ceausescu's palace. And it took me days to recover from visiting that building. You'll have seen pictures of it. The largest building in Europe, second largest building in floor space in the world after the Pentagon, simply filled with crystal chandeliers, marble pillars everywhere, almost makes Buckingham Palace look like a garden shed. And built at a time when thousands of Romanians were dying of hunger. And it's an absolute monument to human folly and wickedness. When I was revisiting this book, it reminded me of another secular voice from the world, which I think says something very similar to what Bauman is saying, and that's the voice of Albert Camus. And Camus, in a book that is not as well known as his other work, called The Rebel, which is a radical critique of revolutionary politics, says this: when man submits God to moral judgment, he kills him in his own heart. And then what is the basis of morality? God is denied in the name of justice, but can the idea of justice be understood without the idea of God? We have arrived at absurdity. And elsewhere, Camus puts it in a phrase that I find extremely memorable. He says, "The sky is empty, and the earth is delivered into the hands of power without principles." Zygmunt Bauman obviously writes as a sociologist, not as a theologian. He writes as a Jew, not as a Christian. Using the imagery of the world as a garden to be controlled, designed, and managed, he says, perhaps wistfully, that in a world densely populated with knowledgeable gardeners, no room seems to be left for the gardener supreme, the gardener of gardeners. Nonetheless, it is clear to him that the roots of morality have to be sought beyond societal arrangements, and that far from being the product of human society, the origins of morality transcend any and all merely local particular contexts. He constantly repeats the view that powerful moral drives have a pre-societal origin, and that human societies, far from magically creating ethics, have often made immoral conduct more rather than less plausible. The implication of this is that it is perfectly possible to behave ethically and to find oneself in conflict with societal norms. And this again is Bauman and not me. Indeed, acting morally may frequently involve taking a stance dubbed and decreed antisocial or subversive by the powers that be, and by public opinion. Ethical convictions do not necessarily contribute to social cohesion and unity. Indeed, they may, in many situations, become profoundly countercultural. Doing what is right may involve resistance to societal authority and action aimed at weakening its grip. At this point, Zygmunt Bauman meets Dietrich Bonhoeffer. As sociological analysis of the Holocaust and its lessons for the modern world begins to overlap with the experience of the isolated German pastor who wrote, "Just as Christ is Christ only in virtue of his suffering and rejection, so the disciple is a disciple only insofar as he shares his Lord's suffering, rejection, and crucifixion." Let me come back to the point at which I began and ask the inevitable question: in what ways can the earlier claim that Bauman's work illuminates the problems Christians have in living as disciples of Jesus in the context of the modern world be justified? Which, of course, is the only justification for spending so much time looking at Bauman's work. Bauman is clearly aware of the ethical failure of German Christianity at the time of the Holocaust, and he observed that the churches failed to resist the evils of the time, and that the exceptions were limited to a relatively small number of isolated individuals. It seems to me that Bauman's exposition of the power of a technical rationality, accompanied by the rigid separation of life into private and public spheres, and the exclusion of ethical and religious discourse from the latter, helps to explain why Bonhoeffer's contemporaries had secularized the Christian faith, making it indistinguishable from bourgeois respectability. And this, let it be said, was far from being a failure of the pre-war German churches alone. Western Christianity in general has been profoundly shaped by the modern culture, which is the subject of Bauman's searching critique. Evidence of this, if any is required, can be found in Peter Berger's sociological analysis of 20th century American Christianity, published in 1961 under the title "The Noise of Solemn Assemblies." Berger discusses the core values that dominate American life, including the crucial acceptance of the need to operate smoothly within the large bureaucratic structures that dominate most of our life today. In this context, American Christianity remained strong and prosperous, and church leaders were inclined to assume that it continued to exercise considerable influence over the American people. The reality, says Berger, is that the person listening to the minister in church is a radically different one from the person who makes economic decisions the next day. Because in the professional sphere, actions become determined by a radically different logic, the logic of business, industry, politics, or whatever other sector of public life the individual is related to. Berger's conclusion, which is strikingly similar to Bonhoeffer's in the German situation 40 years earlier, is, and I think this is a very important statement, that church membership in no way means adherence to a set of values at variance with those in the general society. Rather, it seems to mean a stronger and more explicitly religious affirmation of the same values held by the community at large. With an insight that now seems to be almost prophetic, Berger suggested that the task of American Christianity in such a context was that of securing its disestablishment. It needed to break free from a fatal entanglement with a culture that guaranteed it prosperity, but at the terrible cost of making discipleship all but impossible. In words that set the agenda for our further discussion, Berger observed that the informal religious establishment in America was designed to prevent the encounter with the Christian message. Let me quote him. He says, to say the least, "It is difficult to imagine how the religiously mature, psychologically adjusted church member in our situation can come to terms with the naked horror of Calvary or with the blazing glory of Easter morning. Both his religion and his culture compel him to sentimentalize, neutralize, assimilate these Christian images. If he did not do so, they would challenge his religiosity and his respectability and might even threaten his so-called mental health. The root cause of the problems identified here, I suggest, is to be found in the centuries-long assumption that Western Christianity exists in a cultural context compatible with the faith of Christ. And this has meant that it largely failed to recognize the significance of the changes brought about by modernity, and so ended up, in Leslie Newbegin's words, as an advanced case of syncretism. Newbegin's claim that European Christianity had lived so long in a state of peaceful coexistence with a post-Enlightenment culture that it is almost impossible for it to recover the standpoint of a genuinely missionary approach to that culture seems to me to correspond with Bonhoeffer's critique of the church in the 1930s. At the beginning of the 21st century, the challenge of the call to discipleship in a world within which the kind of culture analysed by Bauman is now being globalised is more urgent than ever. Much of Bauman's later work is focused on the emergence of postmodernity and the human consequences of economic globalization. He has an outstandingly helpful little book called Globalization, the Human Consequences. And the most recent book has the title Wasted Lives, in which he reflects on the parallel between the enormous problem of dealing with physical waste as the outcome of modernity, but the parallel problem of the way in which a culture that has such a waste problem also creates so many wasted lives. These books seem to me to offer a most valuable resource for the understanding of the times in which we live, and they serve to highlight both the great urgency of the call to discipleship, but also the opportunity presented by the situation today. Commenting on the positive responses of many young people to Bauman's work, his fellow sociologist Richard Sennett has said, "Contrary to all the clichés about young people being disengaged and not interested, they are attracted to the idea of ethical action. They want something with teeth. So it really appeals to them when someone tells them that they're responsible for relating to others in an ethical way." This surely suggests to us that a Christianity faithful to the call of Christ, a call that, to quote Bonhoeffer, drags the disciple out of his relative security into a life of absolute insecurity, and involves a faith that becomes real in acts of ethical obedience, so offering an alternative way of being human to that seen as normative within the modern world, can respond to the deep longings of a generation increasingly wearied by the superficiality and greed of the hollowed-out culture of the West. Almost the last words of Leslie Newbegin, uttered in public in 1996, were these, spoken at a World Council of Churches conference in Brazil. "I have said that this so-called Western, modern, scientific, free market culture is the most powerful in the world at the present time. And it seems to me that in the century that lies ahead of us, these are the three major factors that will compete for the allegiance of the human family: the gospel, the free market, and Islam. As to Islam, While the other great world faiths are deeply significant and worthy of respect, none of them makes the same claim for universal significance. As to the free market, the crucial question is going to be whether the Christian church can recover its confidence in the gospel in order to be able to challenge with confidence the enormous power of this ideology that now rules us. Or, to revert to Weber's imagery, can modern people break out of the iron cage in which they find themselves imprisoned? Is it conceivable that entirely new prophets will arise, able to speak a liberating word that breaks open the confined, one-dimensional worldview in which we are trapped? And in this context, will Christians give serious and sustained attention to the question of what it might mean to be the followers of Christ, seeking to fulfill the unchanged mandate to make disciples of all nations in a globalized world?
I have to say I agree with a lot of what you said, but in my question I'm going to do the devil's advocate and say something of the opposite, okay? Yes, it's commonplace to say that modern society has taken away God and therefore ethics is in chaos. But the other way to look at it is to say, you know, when you put in God, you just make the ethical question even more difficult. Look at the rise of modern fundamentalism. Whether it's in the form of an Islamic terrorist, who suicide bomber, or whether it's in the form of George Bush, who sent their armies into Iraq, both of them are phrased in a religious framework, you know, fighting against evil, you know, Bush, the way Bush put it, and so does the Islamic extremist. Putting it in a religious framework seems to make things even more extreme than even harder to dialogue. There are people who, like Mackey, you know, who insists on inventing ethics, is it his book or whatever it's called, to recognize that ethics is a human invention, not something come from above, is actually the way to go forward, because in that way we demask the myth of something absolute. You know, you have to obey this because it's just from above. We recognize all ethical statement is a kind of power play. And therefore, when we recognize as a power play, we recognize the lure or the danger of power play, and we are more sensitive to its danger rather than to hide behind something called a God figure. So anyway, how would you respond to that kind of reasoning?
Did you put it in the form of a question?
Yeah, this is a question. I mean, I'm not Mackey, I don't buy this thing, but that's certainly the way, when some people put it that way.
Just rephrase the question for me.
The question is, you know, if you say morality has to be based on religion, the question is, it just makes things worse. Isn't it we're going from something, running from a fire to another bigger fire, you know?
Yeah, I don't think I'm saying that ethics has to be based on religion. What I'm trying to do is to report what Bauman is saying. I think what is significant about what he is saying as a basically secular sociologist is that the historic sociological understanding of ethics as something that is the product of human society is disastrous, and that there must be a deeper foundation for normative ethics than that.
So some people's theory is the other way around. The effort to base ethics on something deeper is disastrous.
Right, right.
He's saying that Aaron race is God's chosen race.
Yeah.
He tried to make it a religious term. That's the disastrous part.
Yes. I think in the end the problem for somebody like Bauman is that although this is what he's saying, although I think, and this goes back to the comments I made at the beginning, I think his analysis is enormously helpful in terms of enabling us to understand what is most dangerous about modernity. So in a sense, at the negative level, we have a great deal to learn from him. But when we, if we push him and if we ask him, well, where then does this moral impulse come? There really is no answer. There's a recognition of the inadequacy and the danger of a fundamentally secular worldview. But he has, in the end, I think, no way out of that impasse. And it seems to me that, that's happening quite widely in our culture at the moment. I think there are many indications of people who... I try to look at humanist journals and see what's happening in contemporary humanist thought. And there's one journal taken in the college called The New Humanist. It has always been militantly opposed to anything that bears the name of religion. And I opened the last issue to discover the lead article saying, actually, the crisis that we are confronting now is so great that we have to reconsider. I mean, it's extremely patronising that there are some quite progressive people among the religious. But to me, it indicates this growing awareness of both a dead end, but also a situation, given what Bauman is saying about technological power, that is potentially hugely dangerous. What I was trying to do, and I think I may not have done it sufficiently clearly and well, is to suggest that an analysis like this, its most important contribution, so far as we are concerned, in terms of our desire to see a church that is a disciple church, is to alert us to some of the factors that may have led historically to such immense compromises. Because, I mean, what I find myself asking when we think on this issue of discipleship is, we all know that this is as Bonhoeffer says, that the corollary of grace. But the empirical reality of the church so often is otherwise. And I think Bauman, and I would say that this was certainly true in my view of the work of Leslie Newbegin, have helped us to see that the problem may exist in that area that I touched at towards the end there, that we've made so many assumptions about the relationship between the gospel and the culture in which we live in the modern West, that we've overlooked the fact, which many other Christians see very clearly, as I'll be saying tomorrow morning, that actually we have a syncretic form of faith, and we need grace to be able to break free from that.
Could I press David on Finn's question? I think what he's asking is whether fundamentalism is the answer to modernity.
Right.
And many people are saying it is, in by way of reaction. And it'd be interesting to hear your response to that question.
Well, I think my response would be, in a sense, in just pointing back to the analysis of Peter Berger. Because I think what Berger was critiquing in North American Christianity was precisely a form of fundamentalism that proclaimed its faithfulness to the gospel without the awareness of the extent to which it was making fatal compromises with a secular culture. And it seems to me that's a huge challenge to all of us. You know, as long as we are part of this highly technological Western world, that challenge confronts all of us. So I'm sure that is not the answer, despite the desire to express faithfulness to Christ.
Do you think if in our churches we actually stress the cost of discipleship, we might not just empty them? I was teaching a Bible class from the Sermon on the Mount, and we came to the bit about turning the other cheek. And the 13-year-old said, "You can't do that in my school."
Yes. Well, yes. We might. I mean, I think that process of emptying has been going on for quite a long time.
No reason.
Yes, indeed. But you know, maybe in the providence of God, that process, perhaps the process of secularization, has now left us in a situation where we are more able to face the real challenge of the gospel. Again, I don't want to anticipate what I'm going to say tomorrow, because I want to kind of build on this, to reflect on implications for the church and the nature of the church. One of the things I want to say is that it seems to me that crucial issue that this raises for us is the whole matter of Christian initiation. And baptism was mentioned this afternoon. It's very interesting that Bonhoeffer links baptism in the Pauline epistles with the call of Jesus to discipleship in the Gospels, and therefore sees baptism as Christ setting apart people who become part of this new community. But I increasingly wonder whether in a post-Christendom situation we don't need to revisit the church pre-Christendom. Because I think the church pre-Christendom faced many, it's a different situation, but it faces many of the issues that we're confronting now. And I suspect that we may have a great deal to learn from the early church concerning the process of initiation. As long as we operated in a culture that rightly or wrongly we perceived to be Christian, then in a sense this issue didn't come up. But if, like the early church, we find ourselves in a culture where people are so profoundly pagan and so profoundly ignorant of Christ and so profoundly ignorant of the ethics that accompany the gospel, then I think processes of initiation that school people in what it means to say that Jesus is Lord will become very important. And that seems to me may be a really important area for the development of the life of the church in the 21st century.
Thank you so much for such a helpful presentation. I think it's absolutely very vital that, and I think is happening, people grasp the unchristian nature of much of our history. We invented concentration camps in the Boer War. Men, women, and children died. How few Christian leaders actually protested and were considered troublemakers by the church, let alone the government. When it came to fast forward towards the end of our present century, leaving aside the Iraq War, you go back to the Kosovo War, where our government and another changed the rules of law to justify an illegal war. And in press conference after press conference from NATO, a complete pack of lies was told, a fiction presented as truth that has now come out, and so many other things linked to it. It's good there are voices of protest, and I'm proud that so many Christian leaders raised issues about the Iraq situation as we're starting to see about lies of authority. But we need to grapple more and more with these issues, and they will become more and more challenging, I believe, for us as Christians. And that's how I read the situation from what you're saying. Is that,
right.
Is that fair?
Yes, I think that I don't disagree with that at all. I think what I want to say is that, in a way, going back to the previous question, the big challenge for us, I think, is that we are what we should be. We are what we are. That we learn to be a community that gives substance to the confession of the Lordship of Christ. And that first and foremost, that substance is reflected in our communities and in the relationships between our communities. I mean, it seems to me the whole issue of unity becomes crucially important, the practice of real love. What I actually see is too often the opposite of that. And I think the situation in which we are placed in a transitional period between one kind of cultural identity and another is creating tensions that can pull us apart in all sorts of ways. So unless it begins there, and unless discipleship becomes a reality within the Christian community, then I think any statements that we make on issues and things that are happening in the wider world have very little credibility. Which is not to say, you know, that we challenge evil and wickedness wherever we see it. But the quality of our life, our being together in Christ, is I think, the really crucial thing.
I want to just hear first and I'll come back. Thank you.
Thanks very much for your presentation. I belong to a modern bureaucratic technological church. Can such a church ever disentangle itself sufficiently from its culture?
It can, but it may be a difficult and a costly process. I don't want, I think, to give the impression that there is some way in which we can be totally disengaged from the culture of which we are part. Both history, I think, also scripture teach us that that is neither possible nor desirable. It's having a critical awareness of what is negative and dangerous about that culture. And this is the sort of classic missionary question, isn't it? So, you know, finding ourselves now in a missionary situation, we are facing the sort of questions that we've always required people in other cultures to confront. What is consistent with the gospel in the culture? What is not consistent? What is capable of being redeemed? What must be turned away from? My worry, I think, about modern bureaucratic technological churches is that they often show very little awareness of where the danger lies. And I think, they're probably not likely to do this, but someone involved in leadership taking a very close look at the work of somebody like Jacques Ellul on the dangers of technology might be very helpful for them.
Can I just come back on Jacques Ellul?
Yeah.
You say that these people, and Bauman's the same, are essentially always negative in their critique.
Yes.
And yet the church can't afford itself its luxury of being negative all the time.
Yeah.
It has to offer something else.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, well, I mean, I suppose my tendency is to go in that direction too, and perhaps that's come across. But I want to affirm the basic sort of missiological principle of making balanced judgments based on the gospel and on scripture that distinguish between the positive and the negative. And I do believe profoundly that in general, cultures are in a sense that it's a place to be at home. It's a valid thing for the church to be identified with its culture. But it is crucial that that identification is a critical one, that the culture never becomes absolute. Andrew Walls puts it like this, that there are two fundamental principles in the New Testament. One is that the church is a place to be at home. The other is that the church is a pilgrim people, never at home. And those two things kind of are in tension with each other. But woe betide us if we let one become dominant over the other. We need to hold them both together.
Sorry. Dr. Smith, thank you for your lecture. I've learned a lot. I was just thinking, I hope I'm not sidetracking too much from the working of the Christian faith in our own everyday practical living, but as someone who's noticed over the past 40 years changes in work practice, attitudes to life, etc., there have been so many changes, and the sad thing is a lot of pressure has been put on young teenage school people to study. The school leaving age was raised from 15, it was 14 long ago, to 16. And most young people are having to stay on to the sixth year to try and get good marks, with the result that a lot of students have been unable to get jobs, and there's all kinds of difficulties. As I say, I hope I'm not sidetracking too much, but I had to stop studying because of a bad breakdown, and I've had to do manual work, and I'm hoping to keep on doing it, which has helped me. So in Boyman's favour, could I suggest that perhaps young teenagers in the secondary schools be also taught to learn a trade, so that when bad times come because of lack of jobs and technology, they can turn to a trade, and it's good. It gives them a chance to work with their hands and give their minds a rest, and maybe they can think more lucidly and probably orientate towards Christ. It means they're more open to the gospel. Of course, what I say may have its faults, but I say this by way of a suggestion, a practical suggestion for school children to learn practical things as well as technological knowledge. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you. Many times in the past few weeks when I wished I could give my mind a rest and get my grass cut. And I think actually it's an important point. You know, there's a balance in life, isn't there? So thank you for that comment.
I can ask about this long-term anti-Jewish feeling in certain countries. It just didn't seem to be a particular short period. And Hitler's willing executioners, who was implying that they've been known for hundreds of years, and that it had become more focused as a social Darwinism, and then the idea of certain groups in the West as being subhuman, and the general public were more than sort of willing to help things along, rather than it just being a little small group that have all disappeared now. Other things like Hitler's Pope talking about war, things which were avoided, from the machinery and mechanisation part, was IBM in the Holocaust, where it was tabulating machines and sensor trackers, which made it so easy for people to come and pick up three generations. A whole combination of factors.
Yes. Yes. I think what is so very surprising about this book, and what made it so controversial, was that writing as a Jew, in a sense, he sets aside the issue of the history of anti-Semitism. Now, he's quite obviously not ignorant of it, and I don't think he is dismissing it as completely irrelevant, but his absolute focus is on modern culture and the fact that the Holocaust as experienced in Germany would not have taken place in the way it did had it not been for modern culture. Now, if that is right, it's there, I think, that he offers a huge challenge and helps me to see, well, you know, why has the Christian church in the West so often failed to live the gospel? Why have we so easily capitulated to what Bonhoeffer calls cheap grace? And I think that's where I find him helpful, and I think it corresponds with the analysis of Leslie Newbegin. And you notice that quote that I finished with, Newbegin talks about... I mean, who has said before that these are the three great challenges that will face us in the 21st century? Thinking in terms of the gospel, Islam, that we're familiar with. That challenge we recognize and understand. But then Newbegin says, and the market. And talks about the immense power that this ideology now holds over us. In Glasgow before Christmas, there were taxis running around the centre of the city advertising the Buchanan Galleries shopping centre with the slogan, "One mother won't be missed from the nativity play, don't let life interfere with shopping. Now, I suppose it was tongue-in-cheek, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure that it wasn't actually setting shopping directly against the gospel. And there is no easy answer to this. It seems to we're all in the pull of this, and therefore we need to be open and honest with each other in talking about it. And I hope through the rest of the conference we can do this. How do we express the reality of the absolute lordship of Jesus Christ in a culture like this one? That's the big challenge, I think.
I have a queue building. Yeah. Second, third, and then with a little flurry on the back row. We may only get three or four of these before we break before tea. Richard?
Are you saying in what you're saying that you think it is now impossible to be a true disciple, a wholehearted disciple, and work as a manager of a modern corporation? And if it is possible to do that, what should you be trying to do as a manager of modern corporations?
Well, I think that's a really, really good question and a really vital one. I mean, it seems to me that kind of issue is the area in which we have to do hard thinking and theological work. There are encouraging signs, I think, that there are people. I mean, in a way, I think the question has to be answered by a combination of theological knowledge, but also of business knowledge. You know, it can't just come as a theological response. There has to be dialogue in order that the situation can be really properly understood. There's a small book by Raphael Esteban and Jane Collier, who is they're both Roman Catholics, and she's an economist in the University of Cambridge. And it's the best thing that I've seen addressing the kind of issue that you are raising. On the one hand, in the first part of the book, they subject extreme capitalism to a very searching theological critique. But in the second part of the book, they ask, what would it mean for this economistic culture to be evangelized? And how would that play out in relation to the kind of questions that you're asking? And they take an approach that doesn't just say, if you confess Christ, you can't do it as a manager of a corporation, but you must ask how that confession plays out in the way in which you're a manager. And I think that's the way that we must go.
Can you repeat the radical information for
us, please? Jane Collier and Raphael Esteban, Esteban. Trying to think of the title. I'll come up with it later.
Surely easy enough to remember.
Yes.
That ties in with my own reflection from where I now sit with the Evangelical Alliance of the challenge for us to be Christians in a democracy. We've kind of sleepwalked into assuming all that is. And indeed the challenge to be Christian consumers. It's a consumer world, and how does that work? But we've got three or four, and we'll see how far we get. David, you had a question first.
Well, yes, I really I try to tease out more and more the significance of what you're saying, and try and keep off your agenda tomorrow. to us. But there are a number of pastors here, others involved in teaching and training pastors, and others who aren't pastors but maybe church leaders. What guidance would you give in terms of helping us, to, as it were, become more acute, become more biblically expert at doing the very thing that you're advising, you're urging on us, i.e. to be critically aware how to teach congregations, how to disciple them, if you like, in the business of distinguishing between the imperatives of the gospel, the call of the gospel, and simply the assumptions of comfortable modern world. I mean, I think it's ironically you're saying this when we're in the midst of the week lectures on the triumph of technology by Alan Browers. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of us are listening to those and aren't sort of sitting up and getting shocked. And, So how do pastors really engage with these issues for themselves so that they can teach others also?
I don't have an easy answer. I think in all that I've said, I've suggested that you know, here's an agenda that we have to work on. We're in many ways just beginning, I think. I mean, it touches issues of teaching, the nature of teaching and instruction, and the relating of Scripture to the realities of life. I always remember, I don't think it was a SETS conference, but a conference at which John Stott was present and asked a question about the church. He said, and I think this has been often quoted, we have been extremely good at being the church gathered. We have been much less good at being the church scattered. But we are church scattered as well as gathered. And we must work at what it means to be the church scattered. So I think the way in which the Word of God is taught, I think preaching is often unrelated to the realities of the lives of the vast majority of people in the congregation. And yet, you know, the Bible is alive with this, isn't it? I mean, the relevance of the book of Revelation in a cultural context, not dissimilar to the globalized world that we are facing. And that seems to me just to come alive with powerful significance for discipleship in the contemporary world. And then I think there are other ways of encouraging people, giving space for people to be able to say, this is what I am facing. These are the ethical issues that I confront that create for me a huge tension. I don't want to be like Burgess Christians who do one thing on Sunday and are then governed by completely different motivations on Monday. And I think one way of doing that, something that I've suggested locally and we've just started it, it's not my idea, it's been done elsewhere, is where there are people in the congregation who are in positions of crucial importance. So their vocation offers huge opportunity, but also immense dangers. Let them say that. You know, talk to them on a Sunday morning and pray for them. If someone is called to do mission in Japan or Africa or wherever, we will set them aside and concentrate our prayer because they have such a huge task. We ought to recognize the immensity of the task that many ordinary Christians face. And I think make sure that we recognize they too have a vocation, but it needs supporting.
Not the least, Professor John.
I'll just go back to the issue of the Holocaust, because it seems to me it's a very good example of both the value of, I mean, a cultural theorist like Bauman, and also the particular limitations. I mean, the Holocaust is one of those historical realities, isn't it, which often mesmerises us into saying this is an absolute fact about which we can't even think. I mean, it seems to me one of the values of Bauman's work is to say, this is part of our historical experience that is explicable by looking at the development of modernity. And it seems to me he's right in saying the particular form that the persecution of the Jews took in 20th century is to some extent at least explicable in terms of developments of political technologies and whatever. But it seems to me in the end that he, and I think you said this somewhere in your talk, in the end he gets to the point where he's no more resources of explanation left to him.
Mm.
And I think it's at that point that a Christian wants to come along and say, unless you understand one fact about the Holocaust, you won't understand anything, which is what they were doing was getting at Jesus Christ. I mean, in a way, the Holocaust is, it's a defiance of election, isn't it? It's a defiance of the sign of election that's set up in the Middle East, that this people, and among them this particular man, are the sign of the particular grace of God that is present to us and the obligation that we owe to that God. And I suppose that for me is an instance of where, I mean, somebody mentioned earlier about this courteous listening that you have. Well, you do listen really courteously to Baum because he's a really shrewd observer. But what you in the end figure out is that he gets so far and he runs out of wind.
Yes.
You know, he can't run.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I'm sure.
And it's at that point, I think, that then the church does say, okay, we are on our own. What will instruct us at this point is going to be the gospel, and there aren't any other aims. Mm.
Yes, I mean, I said, and I think in the light of what that comment was probably wrong to say, at this point, Baumann meets Bonhoeffer. Well, actually, he doesn't. And that's the problem, in a sense.
Well, yes, he does meet. I mean, they get to this common point, then Bonhoeffer runs ahead of it.
Yes.
Like
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and I had very much the same feelings reading Camus, who I referred to. I think Camus is immensely important as a witness to the sense of alienation and despair that characterises so many contemporary people. But he can never get through. He can, again, negatively analyse where the problem is in many senses. And very often reading him, I think, you're not far from the kingdom. But if only he had been able to hear someone who could relate the message of the cross to the problems that he identifies. How wonderful that might have been.
We have time for one more, but there were two hands. So can I just think very quickly if you can express it quickly? Thank you. First,
first I would just say my commitment to living as a Christian and as a pastor here in North America and also in Western Europe. But my question is Christianity in a post-Western world, is there a time for God's judgment? That there becomes a time when people are so hard, and just thinking about Wall's statements about the move of centers of Christianity from the Mediterranean and Northern Europe and now to the global south.
Yeah.
Perhaps we're living in such a time.
Yeah.
And that sets a different perspective on how I think of discipleship in my own context here in Western Europe.
Yeah.
For me, that changes the question.
Yes, I think that's a very, very helpful comment, and I think you're absolutely right. It's very difficult, I think, to look at what has happened to Western Christianity without relating it to the reality of divine judgment. And particularly if the analysis is in any way correct about syncretism, then that must be the case. Which I think means two things. One is that if there is an indication of divine judgment in this situation, we should not attempt to retain what God is judging. But the other side of the coin is that out of judgment comes mercy. And that if we recognize and accept the situation in which we find ourselves, and I think there are clear parallels with the experience of Israel in the Old Testament, then there is the hope that the God who has wonderful ways of making endings into new beginnings may do that again for us.
And lastly,
You said rightly, in my view, that in post-Christendom age, we do well to revisit pre-Christendom. And I just wondered if you enlarge a little bit on what you see as the benefits of that kind of interaction for us.
I'd like, if I may, to leave that till tomorrow morning.
Well, brothers and sisters, I want to make sure that you have space before we eat at 6. And then before we reconvene with guests, so we'll need to make sure there are extra spaces for them at 7:30 this evening. But David, thank you very much to you for what you've brought to us. Always surprising, David. You never quite know where it's going to come from, but always profound. And we thank you for that. We thank you and John together for really giving us a superb start. The boy's done good, but it's a game of two halves, so see you later.